Road to Cinema's final draft screenwriting software giveaway is about to begin again. This time around, winners will have to follow us on all four platforms of social media. That's right. Follow us on Twitter, @JogRoad, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/JogRoad, subscribe to our YouTube channel, Jog Road Productions, and follow us on Instagram, Jog Road Productions. By following us on all four social media platforms, you'll be entered to win a free voucher for a download of the final draft screenwriting software. That's right, by following us on all four platforms of social media, you will be entered into a contest to win a free download of Final Draft Screenwriting Software, brought to you by Road to Cinema and our friends at Final Draft. Welcome to episode number 32 of the Road to Cinema podcast, featuring screenwriter and director Max Landis. On today's episode, Max takes us inside his screenwriting process, as well as how he prepares for a pitch meeting with a producer or studio executive. Max also shares with us his point of view for the current chaotic state of the movie business. We'll go into Max's experience directing his first feature film, Me, Him, Her, starring Haley Joel Osment, and how directing that first feature film influenced his writing process from that point on. Also, Max's approach for directing the new Ariana Grande music video One Last Time. We also go into Max's work on his YouTube channel, which is called Up to My Knees. Some of those videos include the brand new Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, The Slap, and Jane L.A. We'll learn about his plans for a sequel to Jane L.A., and possibly a trilogy. For more information on the Road to Cinema podcast, to read the Road to Cinema blog, and to watch our Road to Cinema YouTube series, please visit jogroadproductions.com. You can follow us on Twitter, @JogRoad, like us on Facebook, facebook.com/JogRoad, and you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel, Jog Road Productions. And you can now join us on Instagram, @JogRoadProductions. And now we join screenwriter and director Max Landis as he takes us inside his screenwriting process, as well as how he prepares for a pitch meeting. What is your typical day as a writer? Is it working on primarily writing itself? Or are you working on pitches? Are you preparing for meetings? Is there sort of
a... My typical day as a writer? That's an interesting question, because there is no typical day as a writer. I'll go days without writing. I'll just not think about writing. I'll have an intense guilt because I feel like I should be writing.
Yeah.
And this compulsion used to make me write constantly to a degree that was almost manic.
It was like a fear of procrastinating, or?
It was a fear that if I didn't get it out, I'd lose it. And it would be lost to some, you know, when you have a really good idea, there's this fear that it'll fall backwards from behind your eyes to some catacomb inside of you and you can't get it back. And we've all been there. There's in the movie I directed, Me, Him, Her, me and the lead actor talk about it all the time on set. The day before we shot this one scene, I came up with a line. We were both like, that's perfect. That's perfect for this. We were really excited. And then I just forgot the line. We both forgot the line. And then we were like, and we came down to shoot it. And all I could think was, if I just written it down. And we talk, Dustin and I talk about that to this day. We talk about how frustrating it was. Because, I had a nightmare recently where the back of my head was torn off. And I repeatedly heard a voice saying, gather up all your good ideas. Like they were falling out of the back of your head. And it's true. You have to. And so I used to write way more just to, as a purpose of...
Did you ever keep a notebook with you if something kind of came to you?
No.
You never did that?
No. In my phone, I'll write stuff down. But yeah, a lot of times it's contextless. Have you ever taken a note for yourself? Maybe some of the listeners who are writers know this feeling. You'll take a note for yourself to be like, oh yeah, this is a good idea for a thing. But it'll be in such loose detail that later you'll come back to that note and it'll just be nonsense. It'll be gobbledygook. You'll be like, what did this mean? And it was this thing that was, I have one in my phone right now. It says, contentious relationship with teacher leads to violent chalkboard, chalk or touchscreen. I have no idea what that means.
So to you, that doesn't mean the same thing as it meant when it first came to you.
When it first came to me, it was an idea for a scene.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was a scene in. I'm writing two specs right now, And I guess it technically might show up in either of them, but I can't remember what it means or where it came from. And that used to keep me writing all the time. These days, my average day as a writer is just different from minute to minute. You know, I'm in a very interesting like tipping point in my career where all my movies are about to come out.
So you have four movies coming out this year.
Yeah. So I've been selling less intentionally because I don't want to... And, you know, just I've been writing less because I've been trying to focus on what I'm doing next a little bit sharper. But let's say a day where I'm, like, working a lot.
Yeah.
I wake up in the morning. I do 20 push-ups. My girlfriend and I sit and watch Netflix till noon after waking up at 9. And we're both on our laptops on Facebook, and we're both supposed to be writing. Neither of us are. Sometimes we both write like a page. Then let's say I have a meeting. Let's say I have a pitch meeting at like 1 p.m. I put on my pitch meeting clothes, which these days I like to wear a suit or a jacket. I like to look good.
Have you spent a lot of time memorizing a pitch?
I don't memorize. I pitch almost always off the top of my head. What I do. what I do that... is interesting, and I found very interesting, is I talk constantly to my friends about pitches or a script that I'm working on.
Yeah.
And I'll explain different scenes, and I find that that is writing. The more I explain it, the more I tell my friends, the easier it is to actually write it down. The clearer it is in my head, it crystallizes. And I think of that as the most helpful thing I do on a daily basis. I just talk to about my story ideas to people.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky because I have very patient friends. And my girlfriend's a writer too, and she talks to me about her story ideas. And you know, it's not like a now we sit down and do this. We just like are like cuddling around in bed, and she'll go like this and this and this, and I'll be like, that's pretty cool. This and this and this. We go back and forth. And that very intangible thing is incredibly helpful in like locking down how stories are going to play out.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't hear other writers talk about that much, which is interesting.
Interacting with other people to sort of have that.
Telling people the story.
Yeah.
Again and again and again. Because you make it up as you go along every time. And that means you find new stuff. Like you realize, oh, this is a good moment for this to go there.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a good moment.
And it doesn't even have to depend on the person's reaction. It can just be you explaining it.
I mean, it helps if they're enjoying it. You can't talk at people. You know, I can because I'm a jerk. But you know, like I'm very lucky. My best friend Brad like loves when I tell him. He's not a writer, but he's a guy who loves movies, and he's an actor, and he. I guess I don't know what Brad's job title is right now. He's like an actor, editor, host, director, but he doesn't write much, and he always likes when I tell him my stories, and he does a thing I really like, which is Brad's a perfect audience because he'll try to guess twists. So as he tries to guess twists or tries to guess what happens next, even if that's originally where I was going to go, the fact that he just guessed it, I'm like, well, gotta change that. Gotta surprise Brad. Gotta tweak that part of the plot, you know, and that's really useful. That's like sparring.
Yeah.
It's almost like boxing. You're sparring and you're getting better just by seeing which punches don't land.
Yeah. When you actually go into the room to pitch, do you feel like you have to keep it down to a certain amount of time? Are you always 15 minutes in and out? Or?
Well, it depends. You know, the best pitch I ever did, there are two that I was really proud of. The pitch for Frankenstein was 41 minutes long.
Really?
Which everyone will tell you is way longer than a pitch should ever be. But
was it nonstop 41 minutes, or were there moments where people were asking questions?
I would invite people to contribute because I knew the story so well that I'd say stuff like, and what do you think happens now? And it was like a choose your own adventure book. It's the best pitch I've ever done, other than the thing I sold with Ron Howard, which might never be a movie, but Amnesty, Terra Obscura, I had so much fun pitching that. I actually just had a tremendous amount of fun pitching a movie that I sold that I'm not allowed to announce, except for I pitched that in 9 minutes.
Wow.
Each story, this is a problem with screenwriting, and that part of the job, and every part of the job, is that each story dictates how its own telling, if that makes sense. When you are telling a story that's very easy to tell, you can pitch in like 10 minutes. And if you pitched in 20 minutes, it would suck and you wouldn't sell it, right?
Yeah.
But if you can pitch in 10 minutes, that's the exact right length of time. Frankenstein would not have sold and or gotten made if I hadn't written it. I ended up writing a script I'm very proud of. But the reason that pitch worked is because I gave every element of the script that I knew was compelling and important a lot of attention in the pitch. So it was more like a TED talk, like a less douchey TED talk.
Are you ever acting out the parts or?
I'll act out moments.
Yeah.
You know, I'll act out moments, but I try not to, you know, do voices or act it out because I'm already a pretty energetic, manic, intense guy. And pitching for me is always that balance of, you know the truth of pitching? That's like the big secret that no one teaches you, that is because you can't really be taught it, is you have to have good people sense.
Yeah.
You have to be able to read whether you're being boring. You have to be able to read whether that person, what type of day that person is having, where they are emotionally, what they had for breakfast that morning. You have to be like Sherlock Holmes, because ultimately you're not selling your script in a pitch. You're selling the idea. And you can't sell to a buyer that's like checking their cell phone.
And also that the idea that you're going to be able to execute it too.
Yes.
That they're going to have confidence in you, that they're going to pay you, and you're going to deliver them a script.
And that you understand the parts of it that are important to them.
Yeah.
And so you need to identify real quick in that room with these people who you may have never met before, what parts of this are important to them.
Yeah. The first time that you ever had to pitch, was that a nerve-wracking experience for you?
It was incredibly nerve-wracking, and I failed miserably.
What was that? Was it an original spec,
no.
Or was it a take on a piece of material?
No, it was an assignment job.
Yeah.
And this is like 7 years ago when I was like 23, and I did not get the job, but I was very committed to it, and it was about older spies who basically like James Bond when he's like 65. It was basically Red. It was a property that was just Red.
Yeah, older cast.
Older cast. And I had this whole idea. The cool nugget of my idea was that the James Bond spy type, the villain of the movie, was Q. It turned out there was this spy operation, and then there was one guy who had access to all the technology, and they all retired, and then one day that guy went, wait, I still have all these things.
Yeah.
I'm going to become the world's most successful criminal. Fuck all of you. And so he kills all the other agents. And only this one guy's left. And I fucked up the pitch. I focused on the wrong elements of it. I was pitching it to someone who pretty clearly thought I was young and inexperienced and wasn't interested in buying from me. I also once had to pitch to a guy who began the pitch. That was my worst pitch ever. Was 3 years ago when I was already selling a bunch of pitches. I had to go in and pitch to a guy who started the meeting with a story about how my dad had embarrassed him at a party. And so I became very aware this guy doesn't like me, doesn't like my dad, and I'm not going to sell it. But the people in the room with me, the producers, couldn't read him for that. So
they didn't know that he had this personal issue.
Well, they didn't even understand. They thought, oh, what a funny story. And I heard, when they heard, oh, it's a funny story, I heard you wouldn't be telling me this because it's a funny story. It's an embarrassing story.
Yeah.
And by being able to read him, I realized a minute in I wasn't going to sell it. And I just had to sit there, and it was like Sisyphus. You know, like I was rolling this boulder up a hill knowing it was going to come crashing back down onto me. And I did end up selling that pitch, but not to him. And I just remember that was the most stereotypical image of a writer I've ever been, was this sweaty, voice-shaking, nervous guy pitching to a guy who looked indifferent and was looking out the window. Although, I mean, like, again, it's about how good you can read people. I pitched to a thing to a studio a year and a half ago that'll probably never get made, or I'll get made with a different writer, but I did sell the pitch. And during the pitch, one of the executives checked his phone, and I just was so like, are you kidding me right now? And I read that he was liking the pitch.
Yeah.
And was checking his phone out of habit. And I reached over, I took his phone out of his hand, and I put it on the table. I went, don't check your phone during the movie. And it got like a big laugh. But if I'd done that in any other room,
yeah,
I could have really pissed them off. And, you know, it was executives who I kind of knew, and that made it seem cordial and like we're all just fucking around, movies are fun. But, you know, like that was a big risk. I could have really fucked myself there.
Yeah, but it's just like with anything, you just have to kind of read the situation and react to it.
Stories,
you can't be in your own little world when you're pitching.
You can't be in your own little world when you're pitching.
Yeah.
You should never pitch straight from memory. You should always, you can memorize stuff if you have to. I know writers, like my friend Nick, memorizes stuff. But you should always have little gaps where you can sort of just freeball, because you might have to pivot. Like if you're pitching something to them and they're not liking it, it's never too late to say.
You can still change your take around and be like,
yeah,
oh, it's going in this direction.
You can just change it. I mean, if you're quick enough, you can just be like, oh, you're not enjoying this. The pitch I sold 2 months ago, I made up most of it in the room because I became aware they weren't going to buy it. And I was like, fuck this. I'm not gonna, I think I said fuck this out loud and no one knew what I meant. But I was so like, I refuse to not sell this that I changed the entire second and third act of the movie.
Is it different for you if you're pitching something that's completely original from your own head versus something that's an established property, or if it's a book or
a comic
or something else? Does that alter sort of, are you sort of tailoring it for what they think that they want to have in a way?
Well, you have to. That's why it's a job. You can't just go in and you know, pitch your like dream version of the movie, because they don't want your dream version of the movie. It's not, you know, when you go to McDonald's, you don't get to make your dream version of the Big Mac. You got to make the Big Mac like it looks on the menu.
Yeah.
And so imagine that an assignment is a McDonald's, except for the ingredients are there, and only in their heads do they know what the Big Mac looks like on the menu, and there's no picture, and you have to just watch them and watch what they're reacting to and make the Big Mac from their invisible brain menu.
Yeah, is it ever...
It's an unuseful metaphor. I'm so sorry to everyone who wanted to learn about screenwriting. I worked at McDonald's for 2 years, and that's how this is happening.
Is it ever dangerous to sort of carve out a story that you think that they'll like, even if you think that it's not to your sensibility in a way, if you're trying to please them too much? Is that ever dangerous?
Would define dangerous?
Well, I guess in terms of sort of, like if you're trying to carve it out in a way that you think that'll be more generic or more to their liking. Or...
Yeah, more to the, like trying to make them a custom souffle.
Yeah, as opposed to sort of something that's kind of your personal,
crazy thing.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to make money? I mean, like at the end of the day, you can pitch them anything and go write anything.
Yeah.
I mean, like selling a pitch and getting a movie made are removed by 100 steps.
And there's some people who make a living just by pitching. Some of those movies don't get made.
There's a lot of people who make a living by pitching who never get a movie made.
Yeah.
Ever. Or who get movies made and they're fucking terrible, but they're able to continue sort of the ball rolling of momentum. I mean, like, it's all... I can't overstate to you the arbitrariness of the film industry. I can't overstate it. And to a degree that would make your head spin. And people sort of think, oh, but probably at the highest levels it makes more sense, or there's more of an A to B. No. No. How many movies has Uwe Boll been able to direct now? The guy's a multi-millionaire off making movies everyone universally hates.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and people often, like, say, like, you know, you got to be lucky and you got to be good. Those are the two things you need. Because you got to be in the right place at the right time, be able to shine in the right place at the right time. But have you been to the movies lately? That's not true. Plenty of really bad movies just get made.
Are you talking about both at studio and sort of an independent level?
At every level.
Just in general.
At every level.
Yeah.
At every level, it appears the sink or swim mechanic is fundamentally broken. There is no quality control. I think some producers have slightly more quality control, but even then, I couldn't tell you because I'm not in these rooms. I can only speak to my own experience, but we've seen independent movies come out that suck and are stupid and that are hailed and people like them or people don't like them. And we've seen so many blockbusters come out that are just retarded sequels to things that, pardon my use of the word retarded, but just terrible sequels to things that, you know, like, could have been amazing. Like, you see, it's... If there was a mechanic, if there was an algorithm by which we would only make good movies, then every movie would be good.
Yeah.
But the process is different every time. And because the process is different every time, because it's a art industry that is being now run by corporations who are trying to, you know, cause it to manufacture a product, which works in some cases, but not in others, the logistics of how things turn out and how a pitch gets sold and how a script gets sold and why something does get made and why something doesn't get made are so blurry and so arbitrary that there's no putting one foot in front of the other. There's no easy way to explain it. So even like when you talk about what my day is as a writer, different every time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm just digging around playing Shadow of Mordor all day. Sometimes I'm taking a hike.
Yeah.
Or I'm making a short with my friends. Then sometimes I'm in rooms, in meetings with people, and it's like Entourage. And it's like a real, it's like the idea of what movies are. Oh, well, we got to get this actor. We got to do this. Go do this. And then some days it's me up till like 4 or 5 a.m. just trying to do a rewrite that I'm stuck on. Or some days it's like the opposite of Entourage. It's like some like banking simulator where I'm like talking to people in suits who don't like movies who are deciding whether or not my movie gets made. So like it's just so blurry. I've always wanted to give more public advice on how to write scripts in a way that they're fun to read, because that's the best thing you can give. That's the best advice you can give. Three act structure, good dialogue, character mechanics, all these things are blurry, blurry, blurry because they're subjective. But fun to read, also subjective, but less so. And I really feel like the scripts that are fun to read are ultimately the ones that get made and sell.
What Shane Black does, mm-hmm. where he sort of carves out, sort of, he knows like a reader is reading this.
Yeah, so I do that too.
So you have that concept down, like sort of a reader is reading this.
Well, it's different for every story for me.
Yeah.
But I use a lot of Blackisms in my writing. And I didn't know they were Blackisms. Originally, it was just how I wrote, but I've come to recognize that Shane helped to sort of pioneer that, the sort of breaking the fourth wall to talk to the reader. And I do it to a degree in some scripts that's like boggling. In the script for American Ultra, there's an entire fight scene that I don't write, and instead of writing out the fight scene, there is a diatribe against the reader for having expected me to write out the fight scene. Like, did you want to sit and read? He picks up the knife and he hits him and A to B and then he kicks him and does this. No, you didn't. Don't act like you did. Hire a stunt coordinate. I get visibly mad on page. And instead, you know, it's a very piggish, you know, bullish move. Not piggish, although maybe it's piggish too. But it's a bullish move to be like, I'm going to spend a third of a page saying, just trying to make the reader laugh.
Yeah.
At a joke on the page, you know, of this like whiny writer who's mad at you.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's just important just to have that down, to sort of know that somebody has to read 50 scripts a night and that you have to kind of grab their attention somehow.
Yeah, I always want them having fun. I always want my readers to be having a good time and to not feel like they're doing their job. I want them to feel like they're reading something fun and cool. I don't want them checking their phone. I want them engaged. And, you know, way to get people engaged, number one, have a voice.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, writing is, as Stephen King says in On writing is as close as we come to telepathy. We record our thoughts, and then people, just by looking at the page, can hear my thoughts and see the movie in my head. And so it better be a fun fucking experience, because otherwise, you know, why am I letting them in my head to have a boring time?
Do you find that's very important to outline, or is that?
It's different every time.
Yeah.
Some stories I outline rigorously. This thing I wrote for Sony recently, I outlined to a degree that I think ultimately handicapped me, because I got sort of trapped in it. But other things I don't outline at all. Generally, I just talk to my friends a lot about like what's going to happen in the script next.
Yeah.
And I also do a thing where I write scripts very, very, very out of order. Very, very, very out of order. So I'll have written entire chunks of the third act or the second act or a specific scene long before I've written up into that scene.
Is it difficult at all to sort of go back and...
Not at all. It makes it easier.
Yeah.
Because it's like Tetris, you know? Suddenly all you need to do is slip that one hook-shaped piece in, and now you just... Surprise! You just went from having 24 pages of completed script in a final draft document that was 60 pages long to having 39 pages of completed script in a final draft document that's 60 pages long just by, like, writing seven paragraphs, you know? Yeah. Like, there's something incredibly... I call it blocking. There's something incredibly addictive about doing that. And it also lets you play with your muse, you know? And sort of be like... it really lets you access... You know, muse is a bullshit term. But it definitely lets you tap into the thing that's exciting to you. That's going on. Like, oh, I have this idea for this scene.
Yeah.
Just write that scene. Don't wait. If you're excited about it right now, go write that scene. I wrote an entire... movie. I wrote my entire script, Mr. Right, around one scene that takes place near the middle. And that was the first thing in the final draft document?
That was the first thing that came to you as well when you were bringing the concept out?
Yeah, and then I wrote the total end and the total beginning. It's weird to think about. I've done that a couple of times. One time it was just a line of dialogue. And I just kept coming back to this line of dialogue in my head because I thought it was funny. It's the script I'm writing now. Where he goes... a bad guy, a good guy is at a state of disadvantage.
Yeah.
And the bad guy goes, and what do you intend to do? How are you going to stop me? And the good guy is surrounded by bad guys and is all fucked up. And he goes, I'm going to kill you. And then he waits and he thinks and he points at this other guy and him and them and that guy and him. And he points at each one of them individually to indicate he's going to kill them. And he goes, and then last... I'll be tired by then, so I'm going to take a nap. And then I'm going to wake up, I'm going to shower, and then I'm going to kill him, and then I'm done. And the bad guy goes, okay, well, that's very ambitious. And then totally fucks him over and puts him in a worse, in like a James Bond death situation. But I thought, I could see that scene so clearly in my head of like Jimmy Simpson or like Matthew McConaughey or some good actor, some good dialogue actor slowly counting down an entire room of people.
Yeah.
Like 19 people. Him and them and these two guys. Him, you, his friend. You know, and just going down one and one and making eye contact with every single one of them. Because they can't kill him at that moment. They have to leave him there.
Yeah.
So I wanted the entire roster of bad guys to know that if this guy gets out, he remembers you and he's coming to kill you. And I thought that was a funny idea because then when he gets out, you cut to all the random thugs he pointed at going like, oh no, he's coming, he's on his way. It's a funny idea. I don't know, I'm scrambling.
But then
I'm
just
sorry.
to like have a good scene is sort of as a jumping point.
That, one scene can make it all happen, man.
Yeah. So I was going to sort of go into your work on Me, Him, Her. So this is the first film you've directed. You've done a lot of internet shorts. Was it a big jump for you in terms of directing that, in terms of how you thought about prepping, even going into the editing process? Did it kind of alter your state as far as how you saw writing after that?
I'll never write the same again. Once you've directed something, it changes everything. First of all, you become aware that scripts are bullshit and are like every time a critic has ever said in a review, oh, the screenplay by this person and that person, they're full of shit. They're full of shit because watching a movie will tell you maybe 1% about the screenplay. So many things change, just situationally, in the realization of the script to the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Chronicle is a really good example because my script for Chronicle is actually, the movie is weirdly close to it. Like, they're very similar. And I'm not talking just about development or like, you know, like getting notes or anything. I'm talking about the making of the final document of the script, the casting, the director, the locations, available props, available money, the shots that are chosen. Yeah. The editing choices, making this scene shorter, making this scene longer, clipping it so now he's responding to a different line of dialogue, the ADR, adding a line of dialogue to make this script work, adding a cutaway, doing a reshoot, doing that. It's, dude, I can't overstate to you, if a reviewer in a fucking review says it's a great script, I appreciate it if it's one of my movies, I like the thought, but man, movies change. And that's what's so hard about being a screenwriter is you create this thing that's equal parts blueprint and piece of art, right?
Yeah, it's equal parts. But it's not specific enough to be the completed movie.
No.
Which is
exactly
the whole there, yeah.
It's a technical document that outlines a visual orchestra. Because that's what movies are. They are a visual orchestra. They are an orchestra of sight that also includes sound. And you have actors, you have so many different instruments happening at once. Production design, cinematography, set design, special effects, music, all of these different things, costume design, all of these different things are different instruments in an orchestra. If I showed you a sheet full of notes and was like, tell me this is a great movie or tell me this is a great symphony, you'd be like, I couldn't, I'd have to hear it, you know? Because it would be about how it's played. And that's what a script is. It's the layout for a visual symphony, a symphony of experience. And when I directed Me, Him, Her, I became aware quick that once I was on set, I couldn't execute everything I had in the script. I wasn't good enough. We didn't have enough money. We chose to do it in the wrong way. This person didn't like this line. This person didn't like that line. I'm very proud of that movie. I think it's a good movie. But man, like...
The first day that happened, was it easy for you to adapt? Or
no! It was like being in shock. It was like being in shock that it wasn't all in my head. And you know, when I make my shorts, I specifically tailor my shorts for YouTube and stuff to play to my strengths and play to what I have. I look at what I have before I write.
Resources, locations, everything.
And so when I make them, Death and Return of Superman, Jane LA, even stuff like The Slap, Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, all of these things, I'm like, these are the pieces I got, this is the puzzle I can put them in. But when I make a movie, when I write a script, I'm not seeing what I have.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a movie in my head. And translating that head movie is much harder and more disorienting than you'd ever think it would be, even if it's your own script. And like these guys, Benson and Moorhead, I had a meeting with them the other night. They are operating on a smaller level than I am.
Is this Big Beach? Is that...
No. Benson and Moorhead directed and wrote a movie called Spring and directed and wrote a movie called Resolution. And they're operating on a smaller, tighter level than I am.
Yeah.
But by doing that, they are able to execute their ideas so cleanly, concisely, in a way that's really wonderful. And I have a real envy and admiration for them because they really are in touch with it. I'm still getting there. I want to direct more, but it's a process. You know, I'll never write the same way again because now I write to be achievable. I don't write to just do whatever I want. I write to be a movie that can get made in the way I want it to get made.
Yeah. But even when you were prepping Me, Him, Her, did you see holes start to come up in terms of what you couldn't do? Or was it...
Yes and no. But, you know, it was every time it was different.
Yeah.
You know, like every problem we faced was a different shape. You know? Every single problem you face on set is a different shape. And then editing it, you know, is the movie getting made a third time? You make the movie once when you write it, you make the movie again when you shoot it, and then you make it again in post. And a movie can change and transform an incredible amount in those three steps. You wouldn't believe it. It would be like looking at a, you know, someone who doesn't understand life cycles, it would be like pointing at a butterfly and pointing at a caterpillar and saying, that's the same thing. Yeah. You'd be like, no, they're not. Show them a cocoon, a caterpillar, a cocoon, and a butterfly. And be like, those are all the same thing. And if you didn't know, you'd be like, they're definitely not all the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's filmmaking. Yeah. And you never feel like you're done. There's still things. on Me Him Her. And I talked to my dad.
Is it set for release later this year?
It's coming out at festivals in June.
Okay.
We have a premiere, and we'll see if it gets distribution. It's hard these days, but I'm really proud of it. And I think at the very least, people will talk about it.
Yeah. No, it was a great script.
You like it?
Yeah, I read it a couple years ago.
You know all the surreal stuff in it?
Yeah.
We had to cut way down on all that, buddy. Like, because I'm not, yeah, I didn't, thank you for saying that, though.
Yeah, no, it was, no, that's why I wanted to, you know, sit down and talk to you. I've read some of your scripts and,
you know. Which ones do you read?
Good Time Gang.
Oh, yeah, fuck yeah. I love that script.
Any update on that script?
Yeah, lots, but I'm not allowed to tell you about it. Sorry.
Mr. Right.
Fuck yeah, fun
yeah,
one.
Yeah, American Ultra.
Fun one, good one.
I've read most of Victor Frankenstein.
What do you mean
not
most?
Enough to be... Well, I read half of it. I didn't get
that's through. The best one I've read. You quit it halfway?
I didn't quit it. I just kind of had a...
Maybe I'm... I had
I wasn't
a thing.
Able to finish it.
I gotta take a shower. Ouch. Sick burn, bro. What was your favorite of mine, then? That's a good selection.
I'd probably say Me, Him, Her.
No
because
shit.
It's sort of my kind of style of movie. Like, I like something that's kind of very contained and character-driven.
Yeah, that's but, it's a tight one. Did you like the sword fight?
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. Me and Her is...
Well, I also thought it's kind of the gender politics and
oh,
sexual
yeah.
kind of...
I wanted to do a movie about being gay that wasn't about being gay. I wanted to do like a dumb, funny character comedy where being gay was a major element of the movie.
Yeah.
But it wasn't about that. Because I feel like there's such a sort of sensitivity to it in a way that I think is reductive right now. And I just want to be like, fuck it. Lesbians sleeping with guys. Guys coming out of the closet for guys. People trying to kill each other with swords. I don't care. Like I wanted to go like all the way to Z. And I've had a lot of experiences. That's my only script. It's weird that you'd say that. That's my only script that has like real stuff that's happened to me in my life in it.
How personal is that?
Incredibly personal. Yeah. See, the weirdest thing is seeing... There are lines in Me, Him, Her that people actually said. Like, exchanges of dialogue from my memory. And me and a girlfriend, an ex-girlfriend, were watching it. And we came to a scene that's me and her talking in a car. And it was like watching her watch an actress play her.
Yeah.
And me realizing, is this invasive? Did I like?
Did you cross a line?
Did I cross a line? She loved it though, so I'm relieved. She was like, "What?" I was watching her watch it, and I was gripping the seat, the arms of my chair, realizing, "Oh, this is verbatim what happened." And she turned and she went, "That's crazy!" in like the happiest voice, and I was like, "Okay."
Is Haley Joel Osment, is he the actor,
yeah.
the star in that?
Haley Joel Osment.
So it kind of plays off him a little bit.
Yeah, 100%. He's the movie star. He's the other guy in the show. But yeah, Haley has now been in a bunch of stuff I've done. Haley's also in my video of people slapping each other.
Yeah.
And he's in Wrestling Isn't Wrestling. Yeah, I love that dude. Haley's just one of like the chillest people in the world. He had this map. In his apartment, in his like getaway apartment in Glendale, that was just all the places he'd been in the world, and it looked like he was a secret agent. Like yeah. there were pins all over it, and I called it the envy map.
Yeah, he hasn't been out there too much over the last. But I think now he's on Alpha House on Amazon.
Yeah, no, he's in Entourage.
Yeah,
he's actually doing kind of a weird amount of stuff. He kind of had a little comeback. He did this movie about like science fiction movie about math or something.
So I wanted to sort of finish off by talking about Ariana Grande.
Yeah, single lady today.
The music video was really incredible.
Thank you so much.
So first of all, was that your concept going in?
No, basically what happened was I had three concepts, and one of them was her fighting a chair. She was a UFC fighter who fights furniture.
Yeah.
And I had a really big, kind of cool video plan for that. One of them was basically a frantic run through a building while being chased by a bunch of people, like hundreds of people. And it was sort of how the video turned out, but minus the end of the world aspect. And there was one more that I don't remember, but Ariana basically just kept saying, no, I want an image of me kissing a guy or with a guy in front of the world ending. And so I was like, oh God, that's such like a trope. But I got really excited about it because Ari, you know, I've known Ari since she was like 16. So it was like a big opportunity. So I just knuckled down and I was like, okay, I want it to be like a Disney ride. I want to go on like a fucking ride simulator through this building as Earth hits the tail of a comet. Except for then, the most annoying thing ever happened. I directed the video and I'm still so happy with it. Because I love all the different little vignettes and when the room blows up and the scary guy. Like, I'm actually quite proud of it. I think it's one of my stronger things as a director. But then the final image ended up looking just like a million other images because we ultimately didn't have the money to do what I wanted, which was have the tail of the comet comes down out of the sky. So we had these like meteorites. And immediately, like, we got descended upon by this Australian tiny band who were like, this looks just like our video. And it did. Except for then it turned out their video was stolen from another video that looked just the same. And I was like, oh no. And then I Googled Pompeii, the new movie that just came out. Yeah. And in Pompeii, there's a shot that looks just like it. And in Deep Impact, there's a shot that looks just like it. And I was like, motherfucker. Like, I got so mad. Except for, you know, I brought myself back down because ultimately that's like such a trope image. The stuff I'm really proud of is all the stuff leading up to the ending. Yeah. And honestly, at the end, Ariana looks great. Ariana's belt looks great. Matt Bennett looks like a hero. He looks like the sexiest young man, which is funny because most people are used to seeing him as Robbie from Victorious, this like nerd character. But like ultimately what was fun about shooting that video is we had 9 hours to do it. And it's 9 hours of 5 long takes with no money.
Like, hard to see the cuts in there too, which is pretty good.
Oh yeah. We hid the hell out of those cuts. I kept figuring out new places to hide them. And in one of them, we didn't end up cutting. One area where we were like, oh, we'll have to cut and reset. On the day, just because of time, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's just fucking do it. And we ran through almost 45, 50 seconds of just one shot, which was like bananas, especially when you take into account how many extras and the fact that it's just me running with the cameraman and the cinematographer who's like pulling focus and we're running behind them and Ariana running in front of us. And then at the end of when we did it, that was the take we used. At the end of it, we were all just like, even though we'd all run for like a tiny amount of time, it was just that we couldn't believe we pulled it off.
Yeah.
And one of the extras, I didn't say cut because we got to the point where there would be the next cut. And I was so like amped up because we had just like blown through this like giant chunk of the video.
It's like, let's keep going.
I was just like, let's just do the whole video. Let's just do it all as one. But we didn't. But it was fun. What was cool about it is that Ariana, you know, as a person and as a friend of mine, is so just down and low stress. And just like, she was getting dirt, she was getting knocked down, there was stuff exploding near her, and she was just like, whatever, I don't mind, whatever you need.
Was a lot of that practical? There wasn't, aside from the comet coming down, it was mostly just...
There was a lot of practical in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was even harder, because setting up practical is like impossible. And like, it was just impossible. It just felt like a reality show challenge to me.
You had shot it all in 9 hours, but was there any rehearsal
beforehand? No, we didn't have a rehearsal day. No, that's why, have you seen the video online of me acting out the entire video?
Is that on your YouTube channel?
Yes.
I'll have to check it out.
And Ariana posted it too, because she loves it so much. But it's me coming the day before with the cinematographer, because I knew we wouldn't have the property to do a real rehearsal, and basically like breaking into the property to run through and be like, here's the video, this needs to happen here, this needs to happen here, and we disseminated that to the cast and crew.
Yeah.
And there was no rehearsal whatsoever, none. And with that video, we were able to sort of create a framework for it. But man, it was very intense.
Props to you for that. 9 hours with no rehearsal with
so many moving pieces.
Yeah.
It was nuts. I mean, like, and honestly, if I'd had time for rehearsal, if I had had 2 days and rehearsal, that video would be 100 times better. I'm very happy with it. But if I'd had 2 days, there would be so much going on, you'd think you were on fucking Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, I wanted so much more to go on, but with such a small amount of money and such a small amount of time, it was really like an endurance test as a director. And honestly, I started off Me, Him, Her as a not very good director. And I think I ended
Why do you think that you weren't...
Because I never had to deal with that stuff before.
Yeah.
And I think I ended Me, Him, Her, like by the end of the editing process, I think I ended it as a... I think I'm an okay to good director. And then Ariana Grande made me a better director. And I felt it. And I felt more confident now. And then Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, even though it's silly and like bootleg and janky, I think it's the best directed thing I've done. Just because there's such a level of focus to it. I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. No, Jane LA is great too.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm directing the sequel to that in 1 month.
Really? Any info on what we may find in the sequel?
You want me to pitch you the whole thing?
What?
You want me to pitch you the whole thing?
Oh, no, I mean, I don't want to spoil it for people, but anything that you kind of hint at.
If you recall, for those of you who haven't seen Jane LA, Jane LA is a found footage short about a hipster named Trey who has a romantic fixation on a girl named Jane Ryers, who's sort of a manic pixie dream girl, like a little silver lake goddess. And she is doing an art project, some sort of performing art project, which she continually identifies as a bomb. But it's unclear if it's a real bomb, which it probably isn't, or if she's dangerous, which she doesn't seem like she is. But it's more about the way this guy, who then begins interviewing her friends and filming her, relates to her. And we watch him sort of be drawn in by this very sort of bright, interesting character, this girl who's played by my friend Zena Grey, who's brilliant in it. And we sort of witness the slow consequences of when you allow the things people say not to have weight and interpret them the way you want to, you can really open yourself up to something dangerous. And so the sequel is about, again, it's me, and I'm behind the camera the whole time again, so you just hear my voice. But this time, I am a gay stylist assistant named Richie Prince, which is not his real name, who meets on a shoot while he's supposed to be shooting behind the scenes a girl named Kayla Watkin. And Kayla Watkin is like a very sexy, very sexy, very put together young woman who's a model, whose sort of parents kind of fund her life. She lives in a hotel, except for as I, Richie, interact with her, I begin to realize she is, at first it seems like she's extremely naive, except for then it sort of builds into realizing that she has possibly like the IQ of a golden retriever. Like she's maybe mentally handicapped. There's no one home at all. She can't identify a basic function. She's basically a Pomeranian that can speak and is beautiful. And Richie becomes fixated with her because she has a lot of the things that he kind of wants. People treat her like a celebrity. People tell her how great she is all the time. Everyone wants to shoot with her. She gets stuff for free. She gets let into all the clubs he wants to go to. She does all the stuff he wants to do. And Richie begins at first to sort of, it's found footage again, sort of just follow her around and interact with her. And she likes him because she says repeatedly, "I like people." Which leads her to many bad situations throughout the short, but she just likes to talk to anyone who will talk to her. And we like her. We think she's very sweet. But our guy Richie, me, behind the camera, slowly starts to resent Kay and begins to perform, for lack of a better term, experiments with her lack of intelligence and naivete and lack of understanding of the basic mechanics of the world.
Yeah, and testing those limits.
Yeah. And at first, it's funny, but then we begin to realize that Richie really resents her. And Richie's boyfriend and Richie's friends kind of turn on him as he begins to take Kay on a ride to somewhere dark. Yeah. And it's very sick. It's not like Saw. It's not very violent or anything like that. It's all intellectual and emotional darkness. It's not like the first one. It's not as much of a thriller, although a lot more happens in it than Jane LA. And it's just about, really what the short is about is what you want from someone, what that says about you. And if you can want something from someone that they have no capacity to give you, who are you? Why do you want that from them?
Yeah.
What are you pursuing when you talk to another person? And it's very dark. And it ends in a not as dark as the way Jane LA ends, but minor spoilers, but it ends in a very bittersweet, ugly way. And it's a transition between, I want to do three of them, sort of spare time.
Make a trilogy out
of the... Of LA's. Because they're all about women. It's all about the way women get a real rough ride in our society. Yeah. They are fucked over by global society since pretty much day one of humanity. But one of the things women get that men don't get is if they're beautiful, people just blindly indulge a lot of things. And, you know, I love that mechanic because you saw how it played out in Jane.
Yeah.
But I want to say that being indulged isn't always dangerous to the person doing the indulging. Sometimes it's more dangerous to the person who's being indulged. And this very beautiful girl who's being played by my friend Anna Walczak, who played Shawn Michaels in Wrestling Isn't Wrestling, ultimately ends up in a not great place just because people are so willing to interact with her and listen to her and congratulate her and don't notice that she might need help.
Yeah.
And it's sick. And then the third one is by far the sickest and most depraved and the most violent and most straight up like horror film. It's called OLA, and it's about a girl who a guy meets at a party. He's a band photographer, and it's found footage again. It's me again, except for this time.
What kind of camera do you use for that, by the way?
5D.
Okay.
It's a little handheld, piece of shit.
Yeah.
You know, and it looks intentionally kind of bad. Although KLA is going to look better than Jane LA. Because in Jane LA, he bought the camera just to hang out with her. And
so it's supposed to look like just kind of a camcorder you got at the Best Buy or something.
Shitty handheld Nikon something. But, KLA is, he basically steals the behind-the-scenes photography camera from a professional model photographer. And he also is a stylist assistant, so he has a better idea of it. So there are a couple of very well-framed, I haven't shot it yet, but I have them in my head. There are a couple of very nice, sort of deep focus shots of her when something just bad happens to her.
Yeah.
One of which is him spitting in her face, and then her getting very upset, and then him saying, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. Don't you remember? That's your spit. And her going, no, no, you did this. And then very slowly he goes, why would I do that? You don't remember. And she goes, I forgot that it was me. And he goes, yeah, you forgot. And she goes, I forgot. I'm sorry. And he says, yeah, apologize to me. Apologize to me because I spit in your face. And she says, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's a lot of shit like that. It's really fucked up. It's like... It's a fucked up short. I'm very excited about it.
Wow. No, it's great. So the second one should be up would probably the next
6 months. Yeah, it depends how all my current real work goes.
Yeah.
I'm probably shooting it next month. But I have to... It's funny, to play this character, Richie Prince, I really want to shave the sides of my head and dye my hair like really white cherubic blonde.
Yeah.
So I don't look like myself. You know, so I look more like a West Hollywood stylist assistant. And I'm not going to do like a gay voice for him. I might go up and down a little bit, but I wanted him to be someone who would encounter her and wouldn't be blinded by how sort of sweet and perfect she is.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend, my friend Spencer is playing my boyfriend, and Spencer is queen. He is an angel on earth. He runs this, Twitter called Beyonce Fanfiction. He's incredible. But he plays my boyfriend who slowly gets more and more concerned with my relationship with this girl because it doesn't seem healthy. And then this is actually an image. We were making props the other night, me and her. And
oh.
Yeah, that's a mask that she's forced to wear.
Wow. Yeah, that's the dark direction.
Yeah. He makes her wear that out in public.
Yeah.
And whenever people try to take it off or touch it, he screams at them.
Yeah.
And so
I was curious, if you want to share with everybody, what is the significance of Up to My Knees, that name?
That's a secret.
Okay.
I mean, I'll let that out eventually, but it's something. Up to My Knees has been in my life since I was like 11. And it was something, it has like a story. It stems from a very specific incident, but the bigger thing I learned from that incident was that names are garbage. And that ultimately anything can be a name.
Yeah.
And I thought the phrase up to my knees after this thing happened to me and several other people, I thought, it's incredible that this string of words can mean me. And so I set about trying to make Up to My Knees synonymous with Max Landis. Like, that's one person. And, you know, that's how a lot of people are with the era of Twitter. And, you know, they sort of go by their handles.
Yeah, that was great.
So Sad Today. I love So Sad Today. I have, like, a crush on So Sad Today because she talks about depression and anxiety in a way that I, like, relate to. So.
This is a Twitter account?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a Twitter account that's just, like, the dark Stygian recesses of the human female mind. Or maybe gay guy. Or guy. Like,
so this could be anybody. It's not. It's one of those kind of
it feels like a like a minorly the interior dark thoughts of an incredibly sort of an incredibly intellectually gifted, sexually and socially stunted, minorly ugly girl. Is the way the account sort of paints itself.
Yeah.
Who is forever lusting after boys that don't want her, sex that she doesn't like, and a life that she doesn't understand why she can't be happy in. And it's so funny and sick and just brilliant. I give it my highest recommendation, yeah. 10 out of 10.
See, I think the next step is people are going to be coming up with concepts for movies based on some of these Twitter accounts.
I'm amazed it hasn't already happened.
Yeah.
It's So Sad Today is like primed for it. Just a girl who's miserable.
Yeah.
And she writes articles for Vice, which are less insightful and more self-congratulatory. Like, oh, I'm so depressed. It's like, I know. Yeah. I know. We've all been there. Shut up. But
so your movie's coming out this year. So first, is American Ultra the first one?
No. It looks Me and Her goes to festivals first, then it's Frankenstein, then American Ultra, then Mr. Right.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm pumped. Yeah. I feel pumped up.
Big year.
Big year, dude. Big year.